And also to say that if at any point you can't hear me or can't understand something I'm saying, please let me know. I can repeat myself in the same or different ways. So please feel really invited. So the title of the talk is Heart of the Matter. And I'd actually like to begin by inviting all of us to take a few moments and connect inside. You may wish to close your eyes if that's helpful. And just to ask ourselves why we're here today. What have we come for? What is it that we're looking for? And just allow yourselves to feel for a few moments what comes in reply. And it may be that it's very clear. It may be that we have no idea. Or maybe there's a feeling, there's a sense of something that we can't put words to. And so whatever it is that we found, we can ask ourselves, how are we with that? What is our response? Do I feel comfortable, panicky, proud, ashamed, bored, whatever? Just notice what it is that you're feeling. Just allow. There's no right way, no right answer. So a few months ago, I was sitting in a retreat in a Dharma talk, you could say. Ajay was reading Kabir. And it was a very beautiful poem where Kabir was talking about the surrender, the complete surrender that comes just before we are taken over by whatever we would like to call that. Awakening, Buddha nature, God, the divine. And he was speaking about this sweet surrender that comes. And that surrender can come, according to Kabir, only after we have exhausted every possible effort. After we have done absolutely everything we can do, comes the surrender. So I was sitting there listening and really, really being touched by the sweet surrender. So touched that I kind of didn't get the next few lines because I was really touched by the surrender. And then Kabir said in the poem, "You're probably so hypnotized by the surrender that you've completely forgotten the effort I mentioned a few lines ago." And boom, I was back. And so it feels that on this spiritual journey, on this path that we're on, it's often pointed that there's a path and there's a goal. There's a finger that's pointing to the moon. And at least two kinds of things can happen to us. One is the one that I just described, of getting so hypnotized by looking at the moon that I may be kind of moon gazing for a long time before I remember the finger and what that finger is asking me to do. And the other thing that can happen is that we get so focused on the finger that we forget that there's a moon. So we get so into doing our practice well, being a good spiritual person or whatever way that we call it, that we forget what we are practicing for. And a couple of years ago, I was teaching a retreat in Israel, and the kitchen was run by volunteers. So the kitchen was run by yogis like us, who were doing their spiritual practice as service in the kitchen, in that case. And very quickly, there was a great disagreement in the kitchen about what was the best way to do this. Some people felt that in order to practice serving in the kitchen, they needed silence. And others felt that this was actually an opportunity to practice meditation in action, to practice Dharma in daily life, and that engaging and speaking was really part of that practice. So we would meet every day, every evening, when we were all extremely tired. And I would facilitate a group sharing, and they would talk about it. And from day to day, this got worse. There were camps, people weren't talking to each other, etc. So after a couple of days of this, I asked the group, what's really going on here? What is really going on here? Maybe a similar question that I asked in the beginning. Why have you come here? What is your intention? And what is happening? And one person who was very shy and hadn't actually spoken much in any of the previous group meetings and didn't really get involved in this conflict said, what's happening is a power struggle. People getting attached to their views of what practice is and losing track of what practice is leading us to. So in this case, generosity, opening the heart. This was the goal. And so this isn't just something that happens on retreats in Israel to people working in the kitchen. It's really, I find, a very, very common experience to all of us. And similarly, we can get so focused on what we think the instruction is for a meditation that again we lose the larger story. So we feel that we should be watching our breath, and then we feel really bad that we can't watch the breath, and then we start to hate meditating because we can't watch the breath. And we forget that watching the breath is just a way of making ourselves available to something else, that is not us to come through. And what I've found for myself is that practice means much more than watching the breath, much more than being silent or speaking. It's actually about finding a balance, finding what it is that works for me at every moment of my life. For example, with this question of effort, we're told again and again we should be making effort. But what does that mean to me? What does it mean to me now? What does it mean to me tomorrow? Those can be two different things. So how do I bring myself, gather myself to really experiment, to be willing to really question, to be open? And an image that I find helpful is the image of a quest, which is not an easy word. Does everyone kind of understand quest? It means journey, an inquiry, an adventure. And it feels very much that the most important part of a quest is the questioning. And interestingly enough, the active part in the word question is quest. So there's a strong link there. And so in this looking for our own authentic individual way of being alive, we have to be true to ourselves, which means not being satisfied with any system, view, idea. Not sticking to what we know, not sticking to what we're told. Not staying with the comfortable. So this can also be fun. I just realized looking at everyone's faces that it was getting quite serious. So a good image for this is, and we have a lot of fun with this in India. You know, when we're brought up in the West, our only choice usually is to go and buy ready-made clothes. Yeah, something that someone else decided what the color, what the shape, what the size would be. And then here in India, we can go to a material shop and pick material. We can go to the tailor and decide what length our sleeves will be, how long we want our kurta, where we want the buttons if we want them, the neckline. If you're women, hopefully you've already enjoyed this. Usually tailors have whole books of just necklines. It's great. It's great. So it can really be a lot of fun. But it's also a process. So we have to give ourselves time and to have patience. So sometimes really imagining myself as a baby learning to walk. And so taking a wobbly step and falling on my face and getting up again. Learning in that way. And the mistakes are a crucial part of the learning. They're not something to just bear. They're something to celebrate. So having patience, finding the joy, finding the fun also. And when it gets tough, remembering why it is that we're doing this. Even if this why is really unclear, but just reconnecting to this question, to this feeling of why am I doing this? What is it that is pulling me? And making use of all the wisdom and the inspiration that is available to us. So we're really lucky, we don't need to do this on our own. We don't need to invent the whole system. There's a great guy sitting behind me who's really made this available, as well as many other wise beings. And so it feels that it's really letting in the inspiration and the wisdom, really opening ourselves to that, and soaking it in, absorbing it, not letting it just come to the ears, not letting it just come to the brain, but letting it come in completely, fill us up, drench. And when Christopher was talking last night about prescriptions and how silly it is sometimes that every medication is prescribed in a similar way to every human being, more or less, then we can also use that image. So if, for me, 2 pills would be enough, for someone else, 1/2 pill would be enough. So really taking on that uniqueness that we have and really trying and experimenting what works, what's the medicine for me? And so another thing to remind ourselves of, together with the fact that we're not alone, is also that we actually have the ability to do this. We have so many more abilities, so many more talents than we usually allow ourselves to live, than we usually know how to live. And an example of that can be when you listen to a talk or you read a book and something feels true. You feel it. It's as if we have these little receptors in us that know truth. They go, yay! That's true. And so we have that. That is in us. But we don't usually give ourselves the credit for having that. And so many other things. I mean, I've been amazed lately because I get up when it's still dark and I kind of get out of bed and I look for my torch. And every time, you know, I don't remember where I put it, but first time, it's there. So there's this ability, there's this something which is there when we don't rely on sight. We can find things. The same way, internally, we can let go of relying on just the things that we've always relied on and allow other things to come through, other ways of knowing, other ways of recognizing. So this quest is really about going beyond the known, going into the dark, using other ways of being. And in doing that, and in taking these steps beyond what we know, beyond what we're comfortable with, we actually expand our contact with life. It's as if we kind of somehow grow. There's more of us to contact life. And a very beautiful thing is that it seems that a quest, an adventure, a looking for the truth is really a part of our basic humanity. Because in every culture of the human race, there is a quest myth. The anthropologist Joseph Campbell spent a lot of his life researching this. And it's really incredible. Every culture has this myth of someone setting out beyond the known to find out something. It may be called different things, the source of life, truth, God, but it's always this movement. And very much the Buddha's journey, the Buddha's spiritual awakening, was also a quest. He actually really follows this pattern of myth. So in these quest myths, there's always a hero. I think pretty much always a hero. I don't know if there's many with a hero in. But what makes me smile is that in our quest, we are the heroes or the heroines. It's here. So the basic materials, kind of the lab in which we make all these experiments, is ourselves. Ourselves and what life kind of throws at us. That's what we work with. And it's really important for me to point out that this includes all of us, everything that we have. So there isn't any part of our body, mind, thoughts, emotions, etc., which isn't grist for the mill, which isn't a good material to take into this lab and check out. And it actually turns out that the things that touch us the most deeply are usually the best things to experiment with. So whatever has intensity in our lives. So we may have the image of spiritual life as peacefulness, compassion, love, whatever. But if I'm a person that has a lot of negativity, then that's what's intense for me, and that's the best thing to work with. So anger or jealousy or falling apart, all of these things can actually be more fruitful for us, most fruitful for us, if that is what is intense in our experience. And I have an example. So I spend time every year in a leprosy community in central India. And I work with the old women. They're brushing their hair and giving very simple, basic massage. I'm not a massage therapist, so it's just kind of really simple. And so this year, when I was there in November, one of the women that I knew from before, who had always been a very angry person, she used to go around yelling at everyone. She hated all the volunteers, never wanted to go near us, didn't want anything from us. She had gone through quite a change. And at first I thought it was a good change because she was much more quiet and interactive. But what was actually happening for her was that as a result of the leprosy, she was losing all the contours of her hand. So her hand was getting very flat, completely flat. And her fingers are like this. So with a completely flat hand, basically the hand becomes useless. So she was losing her hands, and she was in a lot of suffering as a result. And there was nothing to do about that. At that stage, leprosy's been there for a couple of decades, and this is just with the old age, it just happens, and it's too late to do anything about it. But she was coming to me because she thought that maybe the massage would help, at least with the pain, with the physical pain, but maybe also she was hoping that it would stop this deterioration in her condition. And she was basically following me around and insisting that I massage her and not letting me massage any of the other women and still not being the nicest one of the bunch. And I was finding that every day I was kind of dreading contact with her, so I would avoid her room, or, you know, I would go and do the other women first and then do her last, so that, you know, I knew that then their lunchtime would come, so she would have to go, and all this kind of avoiding. And then one day I just had a feeling, okay, today I'm just going to give her whatever she wants. So I'm just going to give her whatever she wants. And so I started with her, and I massaged her for as long as she wanted. And then I said, okay, now I'm going to go on to the other ladies. And I don't actually think that I spent more time with her than I had on the other days. But she was satisfied. She didn't follow me around. And she was good. And so this is something which is an outer example of what also happens to us internally with ourselves. So we have a pain or a discomfort or a difficult emotion, and we do everything we can to kind of avoid it. And even if we've been practicing and hearing Dharma teachings long enough so that we know that we should be with it, then we're kind of being with it like that. You know, which is what I was doing. Okay, I'll be with you, but, you know, later, or as little as possible, just so that you go away. And so what happens when we can shift that and actually be with someone or with a situation or with ourselves without limits? Without expectations, without deals. I'll be with you so that you don't bother me anymore. Or I'll do this so that I feel that I'm, you know, I'm still a good person. And so also internally, when we are really able to be with our own suffering, with our own difficulty, with our anger, with our jealousy, with whatever it is we least like about ourselves, something can happen. And that something may feel different to each of us, how that actually is expressed in our being. For myself, what often helps is to really feel the heat, the intensity, really feel it. Sometimes an image of a fire comes, and the sense of this too into the fire. This too into the fire. And so sometimes what helps to really be in contact is to get really close, to get really intimate, to really look at temperature and texture and smell and feeling. And sometimes what helps is actually making space, having perspective. Kind of, I call it zooming out and zooming in. This kind of going into something and then making space around it. And having a flexibility that comes with practice to move between the two. And it feels like when we are really able to be with something or someone, it kind of sinks in to us really, really deep. and it joins, it nourishes something that is in us and beyond us. Something very deep. And from this deep, deep place that is in us and beyond us, we are also moved. It's the same place. So when in our lives we are moved by something and it's very clear that it is not me. And Christopher also referred to it yesterday in his talk. Hearing something come through us that is clear, this was not my voice. It was my voice, but it wasn't my voice. And sometimes this can be it feels like a real kind of grace. This moving through us brings something that we would have never even imagined possible. And this last summer, I was working with a lady in the UK who had very severe dementia She was young, she was only 65, but she had very severe dementia that had destroyed the parts of her brain that deal with language. So she couldn't speak, she could just make noises, and with emotions. So she had no emotional control. And she was very angry. And she would spend all her day shouting and hitting. So shouting at the wall, hitting the wall. And she would also, whenever she got close enough to the carers, she would try and hit us. So there were always two of us there. And it was really difficult because, for example, in order to feed her, one of us would have the plate and the spoon, and the other would have to kind of be on alert, so if she tried to hit, they could grab her hand and stop her. And so this was really a very difficult situation to be in. And I really found myself kind of reacting to that, being affected by it. And then one day when we were feeding her one of the meals, and it was my job to be the one who kind of stops her from hitting, something came which told me, not in words, just to stand behind her chair. So she couldn't see me because she was looking forward. And I was standing behind her chair. And I just placed my hands on her back. I just put my hands on her back. And she was completely calm. She didn't try and hit. And I could feel, for the first time with her, I could feel the love coming through me to her. I could feel love for her, and I could feel the love flowing. And so there really is grace or movement or Buddha nature that is available to us. That wasn't anything that I was doing, wasn't anything that I had thought or planned. I just had, something had found a way through me so that she felt the hands, the human contact on her back, and was soothed by it without registering who it was behind her. And she never turned around to check. And this worked. This was a new way of being with her. And just feeling that love flowing that we have for each other, but is so many times stopped. So it feels like the understanding that comes through working with ourselves nourishes the movement that can come through us. And when that movement comes through, it in turn nourishes our understanding, opens our hearts, reminds us that there are more possibilities than what we know or what we think. And so we're gradually expanding more and more into love, into mystery. And this place inside is a very vulnerable place, actually. It's a very tender place. It's maybe not what we would imagine it would be. And in the Shambhala tradition, the tradition of Chogyam Trungpa, they call it the soft spot. I really love that. The soft spot. And sometimes we can really feel it here. And it's a place in which pain and joy are experienced in the same way. There's no difference. They actually feel the same. And the same vulnerable tenderness is in everything and in everyone. It's actually what we are all made of in our core. And when we make contact with it in ourselves, it is more than us that gets transformed. Not just me, not just you. A lot more than that. Sometimes I have this image of us as trees. And these trees, ourselves, we have our roots deep in our humanness, in our stuff. And we're reaching up with our branches and our leaves to our true nature. But there's a solid connection of the trunk and the different things that keep us alive, flowing up and down, down and up. And I'd like to end with a Wendell Berry poem, which may not be the correct words exactly because it's from my memory, which isn't great at the moment. But it goes something like this. Be ready to die. Willing to die. Do you know it? So maybe Virginie will say instead of me because she remembers. If you don't mind.
Willing to die, you give up your will. Keep still until, moved by what moves all else, you move.
Can you say it again?
Willing to die, you give up your will. Keep still until, moved by what moves all else, you move.
Willing to die, you give up your will. Keep still until, moved by what moves all else, you move. So let's have a few quiet moments.